This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for January 27th, 2014. It was an interesting week in terms of the significance of developments, not so much in the term of the number of developments. We were only able to find five things to talk about. However, a couple of those things are going to require talking about for some time. Let's begin with the first of two promised revenue procedures to provide guidance for compliance with the new tangible property regulations. Revenue Procedure 2014-16 modifies the procedures for obtaining the automatic consent of the Commissioner for certain changes in methods of accounting for amounts paid to acquire, produce, or improve tangible property, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail later. Then, the IRS announced significant changes to Forms 990 and 990EZ for 2013 returns that are going to be due May 15, 2014, and they've published a little chart, and we're going to review some of the items on the chart. Then, final regulations offer taxpayers the choice of authority for calculating certain items of investment income for purposes of determining the net investment income tax, the 3.8, otherwise known as the 3.8% Medicare tax. Section 12 of the preamble to the final regulation states that for 2013, taxpayers will be allowed to choose which set of rules to follow, and we'll talk about that as well. Then, perhaps you hadn't thought about it, but the Small Business and Self-Employed Exam Unit may disclose federal tax return information to the Office of Professional Responsibility, and the Office of Professional Responsibility may refer a practitioner to be audited by the IRS auditors. So, if you are a federally authorized tax practitioner and you are not careful about your own tax compliance, you can find yourself in hot water with the Office of Professional Responsibility, which can take away your right to practice. And finally this week, we have a company granted relief from late association status, letter ruling 2014-03-003. Not such a big deal, but I thought perhaps we should talk about that in the context of Revenue Procedure 2013-30, which is the new be-all and end-all for no user fee relief from late S elections and all sorts of other late elections having to do with your S corporations. So that's a little bit about the lineup. Let's get started with a discussion of Revenue Procedure 2014-16 and what it is intended to help us do. First, you may recall that when the temporary regulations for the temporary tangible property regulations were issued, we had two revenue procedures. Revenue Procedure 2012-19 was the revenue procedure that gave us 15 or 16 different automatic accounting method changes that were available in order to comply with the new tangible property regulations. That revenue procedure is the one that is replaced by Revenue Procedure 2014-16. We're still waiting for a replacement for Revenue Procedure 2012-20, which was a revenue procedure that told us how, in compliance with the new rules, we should account for the dispositions of MACRS property and a couple of other things that were not addressed in accounting method changes for ongoing calculation of what's deductible. Revenue Procedure 2014-16, first of all, modifies the procedures for obtaining the automatic consent of the Commissioner for certain changes in methods of accounting for amounts paid to acquire, produce, or improve tangible property. It also provides procedures for obtaining automatic consent to change to, 1, a reasonable method described in Section 1.263 Cap A-1F4 of the regulations for self-constructed assets, and 2, a permissible method under Section 263 Cap AB2 of the Code and Section 1.263 Cap A-3A1 of the regulations for certain costs related to real property acquired through a foreclosure or similar transaction. The revenue procedure also provides procedures for obtaining automatic consent to change the taxpayer's method of accounting for materials and supplies, 1.162-3, for repairs, 1.162-4, and then, of course, all the accounting method changes contemplated by 1.263 print little a-1, capital expenditures in general, 1.263A, print little a-2, amounts paid to acquire or produce tangible property, and 1.263, print little a-3, amounts paid to improve tangible property. Section 3.01 of this revenue procedure modifies the appendix of Revenue Procedure 2011-14, which is the home of over 150 automatic changes, amending existing method change procedures to be consistent with both the temporary and the final tangible property regulations. This revenue procedure also permits a taxpayer who is producing property and producing property which then may be affected by both 263 cap A and 263 print little a to deal with the interaction between those two code sections and enumerates a number of other method changes. In short, all the information we need to make our accounting method changes in order to comply with the new regulations is in this new revenue procedure. Now, the bottom line, every business client you have is probably going to file a Form 3115 and change their method of accounting. If for no other reason, they will change their method of accounting to adopt the $200 de minimis rule for materials and supplies, and they will change their method of accounting to adopt either the $500 de minimis rule or the $5,000 de minimis rule for other items of repair expenditures connected to tangible property. This is not anything we should take lightly. We cannot ignore these regulations. Again, every business client you have should probably be planning to file a Form 3115 either with their 2013 federal tax return or their 2014 return. In any event, it's time for you to know the rules and help your clients make the right decisions. Next, the IRS has announced changes to Form 990 and Form 990EZ. I'm not going to go through all of those changes, but I do want to mention some of them. With regard to the general instructions for Form 990 now clarify that any organization that changes its accounting period must report any adjustment required by Section 481A in Parts 8 through 11 and in Schedule D of Form 990, Parts 11 and 12 as applicable. Then, instructions for heading, Items A through M. The new instructions explain that Form 8822B must be used to report a change in address that occurs after the Form 990 is filed. In other words, the organization must inform the Internal Revenue Service of a change of address that occurs mid-year. Then, the new instructions clarify what documentation must be attached to a Form 990 upon termination, dissolution, merger, or revocation. Part 4 of the instructions, a checklist of the required schedules, reminds us that the instructions for Line 2 clarify when a public charity can exclude from Schedule B contributors that fall below the greater than $5,000 or 2% threshold. Line 25B instructions clarify when an organization needs to answer yes to report that it became aware of an excess benefit transaction with a disqualified person in a prior year. And Line 26 instructions clarify that the organization must file Schedule L Part 2 if it reported any amounts on Part 10, Line 5, 6, or 22 for receivables from or payables to interested persons. Then Part 6, as to governance, management, and disclosure, the Form 990 instructions for Line 3 clarify what compensation from a management company to interested persons should be reported on Schedule O. With regard to Part 7, compensation of officers, directors, etc., the instructions clarify that director's compensation for non-director independent contractor services to the organization and related organizations must be reported in Section A, and further clarify that compensation from a management company to an officer, director, trustee, key employee, or highest compensated employee is generally not reportable in Schedule A. It's reportable elsewhere, mind you, but not reportable in Schedule A. Then with regard to Part 8, Statement of Revenue, the new instructions, Line 1 instructions, clarify that discounts on services cannot be reported as contributions. Changes to the glossary clarify that contributions include neither donations of services nor discounts provided on sales of goods in the ordinary course of business. The glossary includes a new definition of domestic individual and finally clarifies when a VEBA is reported as a related organization by its contributing employers and sponsoring organizations that file Form 990. Appendix D relating to the public inspection of returns clarifies that public inspection and disclosure requirements apply to both original and amended returns. I smiled at that because I've had a couple of practitioners that I wouldn't want to be associated with suggest that we file the original return, but then we file the amended return, and we have information on the amended return that we don't want to be publicized, and the IRS never publicizes the amended return. Well, they're wrong, right? Public inspection and disclosure applies to the amended return as well as the original return. As to Appendix E, group returns, the new instructions clarify how to determine for purposes of a group return whether a diversion of a subordinate's assets meets the 5% or $250,000 threshold for Part 6, Line 5. The changes in instructions for Form 990EZ are generally consistent with those for the Form 990 and the general instructions. Specific instructions for Form 990EZ, Schedule D, Supplemental Financial Statements, remind us that Part 8 will now require a description of each program-related investment on a separate line of the Part 8 table. With regard to Schedule F, the new instructions clarify that Forms 3520, 3520A, 5713, all relating to foreign transactions, should not be attached to a Form 990. With regard to Schedule H, required of hospitals, the new instructions provide that a hospital organization that completes Part 5, Section B, for one or more hospital facilities must complete a separate Part 5, Section C, for each of those facilities. With regard to grants, say Schedule I, the instructions provide new definitions of domestic organization, domestic government, and domestic individual. There are changes to the instructions for Schedule J and Schedule K, and the instructions for Schedule L, transactions with interested persons, now clarify that for purposes of Part 3, 35% controlled entities may be controlled by family members of officers, directors, trustees, or key employees. So we look not only at the individuals, we also look at their extended family members. Then the instructions explain when a foreign organization may be treated as a 501c3 charity for purposes of Part 4, reporting exceptions, and of course by inference, when they cannot. And the instructions for Schedule L go on to clarify that investment management or service fees, but not the value of investments, are reportable as business transaction amounts in Part 4. Finally, if your organization is liquidated, terminated, dissolved, or you have a significant disposition of net assets, you're going to complete and attach a Schedule N to your Form 990. The new instructions clarify what documentation must be attached to the Form 990 upon liquidation, termination, dissolution, or merger. Next, we have the final regulations on the net investment income tax. Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service have confirmed in the text of the final regulations some statements that only appeared in the preamble of the proposed regs, such as definitions applicable to multiple sections of the regs and types of income that are not included in net investment income. Regarding regrouping under Section 469, the final regulations retain the requirement that regrouping may occur only during the first tax year beginning after December 31, 2012, in which, 1, the taxpayer meets the applicable income threshold under Section 1411, and 2, has net investment income. The final regulations also allow a taxpayer to regroup on an amended return, but only if the taxpayer was not subject to Section 1411 on the original return or previously amended return, and if, because of a change to the original return, the taxpayer now owes tax under Section 1411 for that year. Two issues that the IRS and Treasury have agreed to study further are the treatment of accumulation distributions from foreign trusts and how to determine material participation for estates and trusts. And that, by the way, that turns out to be the significant issue that's being batted around between tax commentators is how does a trustee, acting in their capacity as such, as required by the statute, determine material participation on behalf of an estate or trust so that the income of the estate or trust is not investment income to the beneficiaries. To date, the only authority is a decision of a U.S. District Court in Texas, the Mattie K. Carter estate, in which the court ruled that a trustee who hired people to run a ranch did establish material participation so that the income of the beneficiaries in that event was not passive. And by the way, there's a very close connection here between what is investment income and what is passive income. If income can be determined to be not passive, then it will not be investment income. Passive income is always going to be, always is dangerous, I know, but passive income is more likely than not going to be treated as investment income for purposes of the Section 1411 tax. Tax year 2013 is going to be a learning year, no doubt, for both taxpayers and the Internal Revenue Service as they try to apply the Section 1411 net investment income tax. Press coverage has focused on the pass-through issues under Section 1411, but as I said, trusts and estates also are going to be affected by the net investment income tax, and taxpayers should also be aware that this tax liability will apply to their estates even if the taxpayer was never subject to the tax during the taxpayer's lifetime. The exposure, as promised by our president, is probably going to be just about the top 2% of taxpayers, but turns out is also going to affect a diverse group of taxpayers across the income spectrum due to special conditions that may occur not every year, but only occasionally. On January the 30th, 2014, just as we were going to press, if you will, with this item, we picked up an article discussing an active interest in a partnership and S corporation for purposes of the Section 1411 C4 exception and how those would be classified as a non-passive interest by coordinating the Section 469 rules with the Section 1411 rules. And by the way, when the final regulations were issued under Section 1411, one of the final regulations is a Section 469 reg. The purpose of Section 14C4 is really to sort out the gain within an entity where in which the taxpayers are active so that only that amount of the taxpayer's net investment income winds up being subject to the 3.8% tax. Comments on the deemed sale method in the 2012 proposed regulations were not very friendly to the Internal Revenue Service, so the IRS went back to the drawing board and now has turned to rules taxpayers were already familiar with. So the general rule under Section 1411C4 as to whether income is investment income or not investment income uses the principles under Regulation Section 1.469-2TE3 as to whether income is passive income or non-passive. The regulations also include an optional simplified reporting method that allows eligible taxpayers to calculate based on their Schedule K-1 an approximation of how much gain or loss in an entity is related to net investment income if they meet certain de minimis thresholds. The optional simplified method is available only to taxpayers if the sum of the separately stated items is less than 5% of total separately stated items and the gain recognized under Chapter 1, that's the internal under ordinary income, is $5 million or less. Finally, in connection with these rules, wanted to remind you that the Form 8960 is out. It's 19 pages without instructions. Finally, just to remind you that Form 8960 is the form that will be used by individuals to report their net investment income. The instructions run to 19 pages, and the IRS has released draft instructions for Form 1065, how partnerships will report their net investment income to partners, and how S corporations will report their net investment income to S corporation shareholders. Also, again, a separate set of instructions. Our next item is not long, but it certainly is important. The IRS Small Business and Self-Employed Examination Unit may disclose the examination information concerning an individual who practices before the IRS to its Office of Professional Responsibility for purpose of the OPR's disreputable conduct investigation into that individual's compliance. OPR has the authority to investigate whether a practitioner has violated Circular 230 and to propose sanctions against individual practitioners for violations. In that process, it may refer a practitioner to the IRS for examination of the practitioner's own tax returns, and the Small Business Self-Employed Revenue Agent may then conduct the examination. The revenue agent will issue a revenue agent's report with a determination which the practitioner may contest in appeals, but meanwhile, the RIR and the case package are going to the OPR, and because OPR has the authority to investigate and proceed with a disciplinary action while a practitioner seeks a review of the determination, the exam may disclose the RIR to the OPR before the practitioner's appeal right is exhausted internally within the Internal Revenue Service. So what's important here is that as practitioners, we need to be very careful about how we prepare our own returns. Finally, this week, we have Letter Ruling 2014-03-003, fairly routine. The IRS grants a corporation an extension to elect to be treated as an association taxable as a corporation for federal tax purposes and ruled that a late Subchapter S election in connection with the election to be treated as an association would also be treated as timely filed. That led me to think, you know, maybe we ought to talk about the relief that is generally available without asking for a private letter ruling, and that is found in Revenue Procedure 2013-30, which supersedes Revenue Procedure 97-48, Revenue Procedure 2004-49, 2007-62, 2004-48, and 2003-43. This Revenue Procedure 2013-30 facilitates the grant of some types of late election relief by consolidating the provisions of all those other RevProcs into one RevProc. User fees will not apply to corrective actions taken under the revenue procedure, but an entity that does not meet the requirements for relief or is denied relief may seek relief by requesting a letter ruling. I want to be very clear at the outset that even though your approval of your request for late filing is going to be automatic, it's only automatic if you have a good statement of reasonable cause. This is not a gotcha. It's not a gimme. You must be able to explain why, even though you exercised ordinary business care and prudence, for some reason you still didn't request your S election or other election that is set out in the revenue procedure on time. Elections that are covered by the revenue procedure are S corporation elections, electing small business trust and qualified shareholder, qualified S shareholder trust elections, late elections for electing small business trusts or qualified S shareholder trusts, qualified subchapter S subsidiary elections or Q-sub elections, late Q-sub elections, entity classification elections, late entity classification elections, all of those covered in one revenue procedure. The requirements for relief, again, are the requesting entity must have intended to be classified as an S-corp or intended to the trust to be an ESBIT or a QIST or intended to treat a subsidiary as a Q-sub. The requesting entity must request relief under this revenue procedure within 3 years and 75 days after the effective date. The failure to qualify as an S-corporation, ESBIT, QIST, Q-sub on the effective date must solely because the election under subchapter S was not timely filed, and in the case of a request for relief, the requesting entity has reasonable cause for its failure to make the timely election and has acted diligently to correct the mistake upon its discovery. So if you can meet all those, then you've got a new all-in-one place automatic. It's not exactly automatic. They use the word automatic, but you still have to jump through some hoops. Well, that's a wrap for this week, folks. Thank you for joining me, and remember, stay safe.